Welcome to today's deep dive. If you're a fellow member of Harmony Christian Church, you are in exactly the right place today.
Yeah, you really are. We've got a very specific mission for this one.
Right. We are getting you prepped and ready for your upcoming Connect Group meeting.
Mm-hmm.
We have the notes, the transcript, basically all the core insights from Pastor Kent Wagner's latest sermon, and we are going to unpack the theology and the practical applications together.
And, you know, to frame this discussion properly right off the bat, we kind of need to look at where this message sits within the current season of our church.
Yeah, we're right in the middle of that overarching series, right? The kingdom multiplies.
Exactly. The kingdom multiplies. And the stated goal of this series is, well, it's not exactly timid.
No, not at all.
The objective, he stated, is to depopulate hell.
Which is, I mean, that's a massive, weighty premise for any congregation to tackle.
It really sets a high bar. Yeah. And to move toward that goal, Kent tackled a topic that, well, let's just be honest. Historically, it makes people in the pews clench their jaws a bit. Yeah, tithing.
Money. Yeah, right, the money talk. But the goal of this deep dive is to extract the underlying philosophy from the message, you know?
Mm-hmm.
We want to equip you with the right questions and perspectives so your Connect Group discussion this week can bypass that usual awkwardness.
We want it to be rich, honest, and completely pressure-free.
Exactly. And the message actually began with a tone of vulnerability rather than some rigid financial lecture.
Yeah, before diving into the scripture, there was that candid prayer request.
That was really striking.
It was. He acknowledged that ever since the church publicly announced this goal to depopulate hell, there's been this palpable sense of spiritual resistance.
I think his specific phrasing was that hell has been throwing everything at me.
Right. Describing the behind-the-scenes reality as intensely chaotic lately.
And that transparency is a really helpful starting point, I think, because it contextualizes the weight of the topic. But then to transition into the core theology, he used a really relatable anecdote.
Oh, the Toyota plant story.
Yeah, the Toyota plant. Most of us in the congregation heard it. The story about him and Jenny touring the local plant. We don't need to rehash the entire narrative about the noise or the welding robots and all that.
No, but the crux of the story was his search for his buddy, right? Matt McKenzie.
Right, the guy who helped secure the tour. Kent was looking everywhere on that loud factory floor for him.
He was checking the catwalks, the plant's pool table.
Literally everywhere.
Yeah.
But he couldn't find him.
And the detail that matters for our analysis here is that geographical mismatch. There was this frantic search happening on the factory floor, looking for someone who simply did not work in that part of the building.
Matt was in an office upstairs.
Yeah. The failure to find him wasn't because Matt was absent or avoiding him. It was because the search was localized to the completely wrong environment.
Which brought us to that central catchphrase that Kent asked us to keep as an open tab in our minds.
People are never where they aren't.
Right. People are never where they aren't. It sounds incredibly simple, almost like a joke, really.
Like a tautology, yeah.
But the psychological application is profound. When someone is looking for you at your house and you are at your office, they might interpret your absence as you ignoring them.
But in reality, you are just where you are.
Exactly. And applying that concept to our perception of God reveals so much about modern faith struggles.
It really does. The argument he presented is that many people who find themselves frustrated with God or feeling abandoned by him are actually operating under a sort of cognitive bias.
Yeah.
They are looking for God in places or within frameworks where he simply does not operate. Their theology has basically established false parameters.
And the prime example he brought up was that cultural cliche we hear all the time.
Oh, that God will never give you more than you can handle.
Yes. We hear that constantly. People say it like it's a Bible verse.
Right, but the theological reality presented in the sermon is the exact opposite. God frequently allows situations that are vastly beyond our capacity to handle.
Because the purpose isn't to crush us, but to force a reliance on him rather than our own self-sufficiency.
Right. If a person's entire spiritual expectation is built on the false premise of a protective bubble, you know, this idea that following God guarantees a pain-free life, then their theology is going to fracture the moment a crisis hits.
They'll look for God to act as a shield against the tragedy, and when he doesn't act in that specific expected way, the immediate assumption is often that he doesn't exist.
Or that he simply doesn't care. They miss his presence because they are scanning the factory floor while he is operating on a completely different level of the plant.
That realization that God doesn't operate by our cultural cliches is largely what's driving the modern wave of faith deconstruction.
Especially for the under 35 demographic.
Yeah. People are looking at the synthesized, polished version of faith they were handed, realizing it doesn't map onto their actual lived experience, and they are dismantling it.
And Kent pointed out that deconstruction itself isn't inherently negative, right? Not if it leads to discovering the truth.
Right.
The danger is tearing the structure down to the foundation and just leaving it vacant. The goal shouldn't be a void.
It should be reconstruction.
Exactly. Reconstructing a resilient faith based on the actual biblical text and the true character of God, rather than that comforting yet inaccurate bumper sticker theology we often settle for.
So with that framework established, this idea of looking for God where he actually resides, the sermon finally pivoted to the central tension of the morning.
Tithing.
And I have to say, it was refreshing to see the inherent conflict of interest addressed immediately.
Yeah, he didn't shy away from it. There's undeniable awkwardness when a pastor, whose salary is paid by the congregation, stands on a stage and talks about giving money.
Preemptively dismantling that tension is so crucial for anyone trying to actually absorb the theology. Instead of listing out a rigid set of rules, he established a framework of complete financial anonymity and zero obligation.
The focus was deliberately shifted away from the church's operating budget and placed entirely on the individual's personal spiritual growth.
So let's run through those six ground rules, he said, because these are perfect to bring up in your connect group if things get tense.
Sure. First, it's about growth, not pressure.
Right. Second, skeptics are completely welcome.
Third, and this is a big one, Kent has no idea what anyone gives.
Yeah, he said he avoids handling the offering money like it's nuclear waste.
Exactly. And he doesn't set his own salary, so giving more doesn't give him a raise.
Fourth rule, listeners have permission to just listen. You don't have to decide anything right now.
Fifth, the focus is on understanding, which should lead to application.
And finally, the response is strictly between the individual and God.
Setting that up was brilliant. The anonymity is a powerful tool for a connect group discussion. Knowing that the leadership removes themselves from the transaction removes the defensive walls.
It allows you to view the message not as a fundraising pitch, but as a genuine exploration of scripture.
Which brings us to the text itself. Old Testament prophet Malachi chapter 3, verses 6 through 12.
Yeah, the framing of this passage is essentially a courtroom drama. Malachi is the prosecuting attorney laying out a divine case against the Israelites.
And the trial opens with this massive declaration of character from the judge's bench. God prefaces his entire argument with the statement, "I, the Lord, do not change."
That immutability is the bedrock of the text. God's faithfulness isn't a sliding scale that fluctuates based on human behavior.
It is rooted entirely in his own unchanging nature.
Which is fortunate, given humanity's historical track record.
Yeah. Kent did a quick survey of biblical history showing that consistent pattern of human failure. Adam and Eve violated the one boundary they were given.
Abraham lacked the patience to trust a divine timeline and attempted to force the issue by sleeping with another woman.
Moses allowed frustration to override obedience and performed an unsanctioned miracle.
It's just a continuous cycle of a perfectly faithful God dealing with a people who habitually fracture the relationship.
And to illustrate how God responds to that continuous fracturing, we heard that vivid analogy of the runaway kid.
Oh, that was a great visual. Most of us can picture that clearly a 6 or 7-year-old gets into a heated argument with their parents, packs a tiny suitcase, and marches out the front door, absolutely determined to leave home.
The imagery of Kent following his kid out to the end of the driveway is deeply theological.
Yeah, instead of reacting with vindictive anger or forcefully dragging the child back inside by the ear, the father simply stands at the edge of the property.
He offers gentle realism about the cold and the lack of food, but ultimately issues an invitation. You don't have to leave. We want you here. Just turn around and come back inside.
And the kid eventually turns around and marches back into the house. The parallel to Malachi is striking. When we picture the God of the Old Testament, the cultural bias is often to imagine a wrathful deity waiting to drop the hammer on humanity.
But the text presents God saying, "Return to me and I will return to you."
He is the father in the driveway, offering an open invitation to come back to the house.
Now, the philosophical friction arises with the very next question. The Israelites naturally ask, "How are we to return?"
Right. And if we evaluate our own modern assumptions, we might expect the answer to be about, I don't know, playing tambourines, holding a revival, or just reading the Bible more.
Adopting a stricter moral code, yeah. But the actual answer provided in the text is jarring. It completely subverts expectations.
God's response to "how do we return" is literally, stop robbing me.
It's a bizarre juxtaposition. You have this tender image of a father inviting his child home, immediately followed by an accusation that equates the Israelites to common thieves.
Kent's story about being an 18-year-old house sitter perfectly captured the absurdity of it.
Right, the couple who casually mentioned they had a recurring cat burglar who would break in just to eat breakfast.
Such a funny, bizarre image, but it highlights how jarring God's accusation is. To understand why God equates withholding money to robbery, we have to look at the historical context Kent provided.
Yeah, we have to deeply contextualize the agrarian economy of ancient Israel and the specific function of the storehouse.
In first century Judaism and the Old Testament, the storehouse wasn't a metaphorical concept.
No, it was a physical location where the tithes were kept to feed the priests and the Levites. The Levites were the Israelite tribe entirely dedicated to religious and societal duties, and they weren't given land to farm.
Which meant their literal survival depended on the obedience of the rest of the nation.
Exactly. If the Israelites decided to withhold their tithe, it wasn't just a spiritual failing, it was a communal dereliction of duty.
The Levites would literally starve. Robbing God meant starving the spiritual infrastructure of the nation.
And this isn't an isolated Old Testament concept either. Kent connected this directly to the New Testament using the Apostle Paul in 1 Corinthians 9.
Right. Paul argues that those who preach the gospel should receive their living from it.
This brings us to the critical pivot of the theology today. And this is where that open tab regarding the Toyota plant becomes essential to close.
Yes, let's reopen that tab. People are never where they aren't. If we read Malachi 3 without that understanding, we risk falling into the most dangerous theological trap regarding money.
The prosperity gospel.
The prosperity gospel. This is the false theology that basically reduces giving to a transactional magic trick.
It treats God like a cosmic vending machine. It suggests that financial inputs from the believer guarantee material wealth outputs from heaven, that you can manipulate God into providing a Cadillac or massive bank accounts simply by cutting a check.
And that transactional mindset is exactly how a surface-level reading of Malachi is often abused. In the text, God tells the Israelites, "You are under a curse because you are robbing me."
If a leader wants to weaponize that text, it sounds like a direct threat. Give your 10% to turn on the blessing faucet or hold it back, and God will turn on the curse faucet.
But the nuance of the Hebrew text, as Kent unpacked it, completely refutes that transactional reading. God does not say, "I will actively curse you." He says, "You are under a curse."
It is a description of a state of being, not a threat of divine retaliation or a capricious curse.
That is a massive paradigm shift. God isn't sitting in heaven actively zapping people with financial ruin because their offering was light.
The curse is the natural consequence of where a person has chosen to reside.
By refusing to trust God with their resources, the individual has actively chosen to step outside the perimeter of his blessing.
They've walked down the driveway with their suitcase and chosen the isolation of self-reliance.
It perfectly mirrors Jesus' teaching in Matthew 6. The mandate isn't to live recklessly and assume God will fund a selfish lifestyle. The mandate is to seek first the kingdom of God.
With the promise that our needs will be met as a byproduct of that alignment, the blessing is found in the proximity to the Father, not in the manipulation of his resources.
Which brings us to what might be the most challenging discussion point for our Connect groups this week, the trust equation.
Yeah, this is the core of it.
The ultimate challenge presented wasn't about church budgets. It was a mathematical and spiritual question. Do we actually believe that we are better off with 90% of our income residing inside the blessing of God than we are with 100% of our income relying entirely on our own strength?
Navigating that equation in today's economy is difficult. Inflation is high, housing costs are astronomical. Choosing to relinquish 10% of an income requires a profound level of trust that honestly defies economic logic.
It requires a belief that the 90%, when managed within the parameters of God's wisdom, will stretch further and provide more peace than the whole amount managed in isolation.
And that level of trust is exactly what Harmony Christian is trying to cultivate with their 90-day challenge.
The premise is bold. The church is offering a unique money-back guarantee. If someone commits to tithing for 90 days to step into that trusting relationship and doesn't see God show up in their life, the church will completely refund the money.
It is a striking proposition, and it certainly forces the issue of trust to the forefront.
Okay, let me play devil's advocate here for a second, because this is exactly the kind of debate that should happen in our Connect groups.
Sure.
If the prosperity gospel is dangerous because it treats God like a cosmic vending machine, isn't offering a literal money-back guarantee risking the exact same transactional mindset?
That's a fair question.
It sounds remarkably like a retail pitch, right? Try God for 90 days, risk-free. How does the church reconcile offering a refund with the concept of purely trusting God without strings attached?
It is a highly valid critique and one that requires careful discernment. On the surface, it does mimic a consumer-driven guarantee, but the distinction lies in the intent and the desired outcome.
How so?
The guarantee isn't promising a material return on investment. It isn't promising that a tithe will result in a sudden promotion or a financial windfall. The guarantee is focused on the character of God.
Okay.
It is a pastoral tool designed to lower the barrier of entry for someone who is just paralyzed by skepticism. The church is essentially absorbing the perceived financial risk to encourage the congregant to take that first step toward obedience.
I see.
The ultimate goal is that during those 90 days, the individual experiences a shift in perspective that renders the guarantee irrelevant.
That makes a lot of sense. It's like training wheels for a trusting relationship. And to further prove that the underlying motive isn't financial greed, Kent ended with what I thought was a brilliant rhetorical move.
Yeah, taking away the excuse.
Exactly. If anyone in the congregation thinks he's just a snake in the grass after their money, he entirely dismantled that smokescreen.
By explicitly giving the congregation permission to take their tithe to other local churches.
The focus was cemented squarely on the individual's spiritual health. He named specific local options. He said, go give to Grace Christians Youth Center or Regeneration Church, or Pastor Andrew at the neighboring Methodist church.
Proving that the objective isn't Harmony's budget, it's the individual's trusting relationship with God.
It strips away all the usual defenses. The plea at the end of the message was incredibly direct. Stop faking it.
Yeah. In church culture, there is a pervasive habit of pretending we have immaculate faith while our practical lives demonstrate the exact opposite.
The invitation was to look at our financial ledgers, not as a source of guilt, but as an honest mirror of our trust. If the ledger shows a lack of trust, the healthiest response isn't to try harder. It's to confess that lack of trust to God.
You cannot reconstruct a genuine faith on a foundation of pretense.
As you prepare for your Connect group, that is the perfect framework for your discussion. It isn't about comparing percentages or debating budgets. It's an invitation to evaluate where your trust actually resides.
Are you in the house experiencing the complex but rewarding reality of dependence on God? Or are you standing in the driveway, tightly gripping the suitcase of your own autonomy?
Before we wrap up today's deep dive, we want to offer one final provocative concept for you to ponder before your meeting.
Yeah, this is something to really chew on.
We have spent this entire time analyzing the financial ledger as a metric of our trust. But what happens if we apply that exact same theological lens to the ledger of our time?
That is a profound shift in metrics. In the modern landscape, attention is arguably a more finite and valuable currency than capital.
Absolutely. Money could be earned, lost, and earned again. Time and attention are strictly non-renewable resources.
If our checkbooks reveal our trust in God's provision, what do our daily calendars and our smartphone screen time reports reveal about our presence?
Could our daily schedules be the ultimate modern storehouse? We have to ask ourselves if we are trusting God with the margins of our days, offering him the first fruits of our focus and attention.
Or are we acting as cat burglars within our own lives, robbing God and the people around us of our presence, while giving the overwhelming majority of our time to endless scrolling and digital distraction?
If people are never where they aren't, it demands an honest assessment of where our attention is currently localized. Are we choosing the difficult but enriching blessing of being deeply present? Or are we quietly opting for the isolation of a perpetually distracted life?
It is a challenging paradigm to bring into your discussions this week.
It really is. We hope this deep dive has provided you with a robust theological framework and plenty of analytical material to explore. We wish you an amazing, fruitful, and honest Connect group discussion. Thanks for joining us, and we will catch you on the next deep dive.